Good evening. It's great to be here with you folks. I hear it's end of term here, and so it's a busy time, so I appreciate you taking the time to come out. I'm currently on a book tour in the U.S., and I've been I started off doing it at bookstores and then have been traveling to universities and law schools now. And this is the first stop internationally. I did Cambridge yesterday. Today is Oxford, and tomorrow is University of London. So it's really good to be here with you. I'd like to thank the Refugee Studies Center for their support. I'd like to thank Jiho and Simon for their work into putting this event together. Simon's was my main contact here, who organized everything. He's an Oxford native who works here at the university. And Jiho and his fiance, they interestingly, we just went out to dinner beforehand and learned that they worked for years at Hanawon in South Korea, which is the center when North Korean refugees get to South Korea. They have to spend a few months, 2 to 3 months there, kind of orientation and to get acclimated to a free society. So I've always wanted to meet somebody that works there, and I didn't even, just found out that tonight. So they have a very valuable experience as well. So the format for today is just I'll talk for about half an hour about my story, then we'll open it up to questions. Look forward to having a dialogue with you. We had some great conversations at Cambridge yesterday, and then after that we'll end in about an hour, and I'll be around afterwards to chat with whoever wants to one-on-one. I guess just to summarize, I spent 4 years living at the China-North Korea border. That was my home. This is a picture actually of the China-North Korea border. There's a river called the Tumen River, which divides the two countries. And on the right side is North Korea. Here in this picture on the left side is China. And you see me sitting on that rock. We would often visit the border and take trips over there. We'd take visitors to see the river that refugees would cross when they're escaping the regime. I spent 4 years there interviewing refugees, lived with them. There's a lot of experts here, it sounds like, with refugee experts. We have a couple North Korean experts as well. And in other fields, my expertise comes from just spending a lot of time with North Koreans, and I'd hide out in shelters together with them, and help them, doing sleepovers and playing games, going hiking in the mountains, and I did that for 4 years and got to know them quite well throughout that period. And I would just sit with pen and paper in hand. They were fascinated with how interested I was with their country and their experiences, and they just talked for hours, and I'd take notes. Eventually, I upgraded to a digital recorder and started recording these conversations and ended up writing this book based on my experience, which is just topically organizing the core of the book really being the testimonies of the refugees. And, I have a chapter on the famine, a chapter on the gulags, a chapter on, a couple of chapters on the Underground Railroad, a chapter on sex trafficking, and that is the topic of my book and the layout. I guess it's important to mention before jumping to the next slide is as I was thinking about how to write this book, I really thought about what's the message I want to communicate. Because walking away from the border after 4 years, I had to really think through, there's so many different ways I could tell this story. And I took several months off before even doing any more writing. And in the end, I said I wanted this to be inspirational. Because really, when I think about my time at the border, I was inspired, and these North Koreans changed my life. They taught me a philosophy of life. They taught me to overcome great challenges. And one of the things I write in the introduction of my book is, if the North Koreans can overcome their mountains, then I can make it over this next hill of mine. And it's a real philosophy I've adopted. They've overcome what the UN has labeled the worst modern day famine. They've been through political prison camps. They've the women have been sex trafficked. They've ventured into a country without any rights, not knowing the language, and I think of I really drew from that experience, their experience, and seeing them overcome everything that they had been through. It really gave me a philosophy of life to overcome the challenges in my life as well, and I wanted to communicate that, the story of heroes. And so I'll just be telling you about a few heroes tonight. In the chapter as well, I have a book, a chapter titled Heroes. I guess to start, I'll just read an opening paragraph in the book. This is the first chapter, or the first paragraph of my introduction. In November 2004, I was in Northern Laos, standing in the back of a truck with six angry soldiers pointing their AK-47s at me. I was leading two North Korean refugee women through the 6,000-mile, modern-day underground railroad that begins in North Korea and runs through China and Southeast Asia. We hope to gain asylum for them in South Korea. We have just legally crossed the border from southern China into Laos and had been captured by Border Patrol soldiers. As I stood there with my hands in the air, I thought to myself, how in the world did I ever get myself into this? It seems like another world when I was standing there in limbo between China and Laos, six angry Border Patrol soldiers, with their AK-47 pointed. And I remember just distinctly thinking to myself, what in the world am I doing? And how in the world did I ever get myself into this? And to answer that question, I have to take you back to July 2001. And at that time, I was doing financial planning in Chicago. I was born and raised there. I had my own financial planning business. Clientele was growing. Had a very normal life. I was awarded most revenue generation in the office that month. And I just hired my own personal assistant. And I asked my assistant to clear my calendar for 2 weeks, took a trip to North Korea. And while there at the border in Northeast China, I met a North Korean refugee. And someone pointed to her and to this young girl and said, Mike, guess how old this girl is? And this was in a shelter. I said, guess how old this girl is? And I had been playing with her all this time. And I said, I guess maybe she's 7 years old. And she said, she's actually 13. And I was just blown away. I've had so many children where I couldn't believe their age. I mean, this girl I thought was, I was like tickling her, you know, patting on the head, and found out she was 13 years old. And through that was my, gateway to learning about the situation over at the North Korea border. When she said, she's a North Korean refugee, the woman said, she's a North Korean refugee, my response was, what's a North Korean refugee? I'm a Korean American born and raised in the States, but I had never heard of a North Korean refugee in 2001. There was a lot of unfamiliarity on the issue. And I said, why are there North Koreans here in China? And that was the beginning of me learning about their journey into China, escaping from the regime for political reasons, for famine, for religious persecution, in search for a better financial life. And I learned about the sex trafficking problem. On that trip, I learned about women who had been sold to the highest-paying Chinese man, and was just blown away by it all. I mean, seeing this little girl, my first encounter, with this North Korean, seeing this little girl who had to shave several years off of her age, and that's another thing I learned on that trip is that North Korean children are, on average, much shorter than their South Korean counterparts, and they have to shave several years off of their age, or people get suspicious. You know, why? If she told people she was 13, people would kind of be suspicious. Why do you look? Why are you so short? Why are you so malnourished? And so as a result, they have to shave several years off of their age. So I learned about the famine that they endured. And I returned to the U.S. I returned to Chicago, and I distinctly remember just feeling, the North Koreans were on my mind, just feeling really disengaged from it all. And I distinctly remember sitting across from clients and talking about mutual funds and stocks and retirement planning and feeling very disengaged from it all. And I decided, took a few months, just really wrestled with wanting to do something to help. I had a very normal life, and it was just something I couldn't ignore. And I said, once in my life, I have to do something like this, and I'm gonna move to the border and help out these people, do whatever I can to help out. So I tell people it's kind of like we have a U.S. Peace Corps where people will go abroad and spend a few years to serve in a certain area. I'm sure you have the same thing here. And I tell people it's kind of like that. While I was single, young, mobile, I wanted to do something and I could take some risk. I wanted to move to the border and help the North Koreans. So I decided that I was going to do that. And I called my mom to tell her the good news. And she flipped out on the phone. We didn't immigrate to the U.S. so you could throw away your life or something like this. She screamed for about 10 minutes, and for the first time in my life, she hung up the phone on me. And long story short, we fought for several months, and eventually she came around, and she's now became one of our biggest donors and supporters. one of my biggest supporters emotionally, morally, financially as well. So I made the journey over to the border, New Year's Day 2003. I moved to the China-North Korea border, bought a one-way ticket, had two duffel bags, and made my way over there. And as I was learning about the environment, one of the first things I engaged in is something we call rescues, which is helping North Koreans get to South Korea via a variety of methods. And one of the first encounters I had was these four teenagers. I guess a little bit of background would be helpful. It's still largely unknown, but there's a modern-day underground railroad in Asia, and it runs about 6,000 miles from Pyongyang, North Korea, through North Korea, the northern part of North Korea, through Northeast China, into southern China, and then eventually through the Southeast Asian countries, that's Myanmar, Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, and ultimately to Thailand, Bangkok, which is the first place where the country will actually allow them to get to South Korea via third country. So once they get to Bangkok, Thailand, they walk into the South Korean embassy. They're granted refugee status after a series of interviews. And after several months, how long is it now in Bangkok, Thailand? How much time do they spend there now? When I was there, it was about 9 months or something.
Recently, we mobilized 1 or 2 months.
Yeah. So it's been, the time has been shortened a lot. Now, within, it used to be 9 months that they'd be there being interviewed, you know, checking their stories and facts, and now it's 1 or 2 months that they'll make it to Seoul, Korea. So I met these four teenagers. We operated on this underground railroad. Oh, and you know, I tell people, I explain it, it's a lot like the underground railroad during the Civil War in the U.S. to help slaves get to the north, to freedom in the north, or like Jewish refugees during the Holocaust, helping them escape through a underground, clandestine underground network. So we operated on this railroad, and it's fascinating to me that this is still so largely unknown. Something has gone, this is currently going on in Asia, this informal network where people are helping North Koreans escape from the regime. We operated on there, and I met four teenagers. They were aged 16 to 18, and I just fell in love with them, heard their stories. They had been through a lot and suffered a great deal, and this was my first year in the country, and I said I wanted to help them get to South Korea. So I started meeting with some of the experts that were doing this type of work, helping them get into a foreign consulate. So you may have seen some clips. This clip right here, which is on the cover of my book, is a Japanese consulate in Shenyang, China, in Northeast China. And you see North Koreans trying to rush into the consulate. And once they get through the gates, they're on sovereign ground. And you know, if that country is sympathetic to their cause, they'll be sent to South Korea. And you see a picture, they're illustrating this journey into the embassy. So at that time, that seemed like the best method. So I began to meet with people saying, hey, can you take these four teenagers to do this type of work? And people told me their plans. Some said no. And some outlined their plans for me and told me their success rate, their guess on the success rate. And I just wasn't comfortable with their plan. So I began researching on my own embassies, consulates, where security was weak, and we can get them through Chinese security into their consulate. So I had a tip that a friend said, check out the British consulate in Shanghai, China. So I traveled to Shanghai, jumped on a plane. I sat inside the consulate and kind of got a feel for security and noticed that the Chinese guard up front, he was a bit overweight. He seemed careless. And I thought, well, this might be a good spot. We just have to get the teenagers through, past the Chinese guard into the British consulate, and then we'll be okay. So, I got a visa form, pretended like I was, looking at the visas, interested in a visa, and said, this is the spot. I traveled back to the border and met with these children and told them, this is the situation, and they begged me for 100% guaranteed. They said, Teacher Kim, and in the Korean culture, teacher is a respectful way to address somebody. He said, Teacher Kim, please give us 100% guarantee that we'll be safe. And one person doing this type of work told me, they said, Mike, if you ever do this, make sure to tell them that they could be captured, they could be repatriated, they could be tortured, and possibly executed, because you don't want to live with that on your conscience. If something like that does happen. So I took that advice to heart, and I told them, I can't make any guarantees. This is the plan, this is the situation, you guys have to make the decision. In the end, the warrior in them overcame. And I often refer to them as child warriors, because they were clearly children. You could tell, they're 16 to 18, on the train ride to Shanghai, China. To Shanghai, they were playing games on my cell phone, they were playing around on the bunk beds of the train, they were tickling each other or pinching each other, and it just really felt like a sleepover, a slumber party. And when we got to China, it was in the morning, July 4th morning, and I asked them, I said, what do you want to eat? You guys can have anything for this, your last meal outside of the consulate. And they said, whatever you want, teacher. And I said, have you ever had McDonald's before? And they said, no, they had never had McDonald's. They said, what's McDonald's? And I said, you guys got to experience McDonald's. So I took them there, and this was like 7:30, 8 in the morning. And I didn't know at that time that McDonald's in China, they didn't serve a breakfast menu. So we started off our day with Big Mac, Coke and fry at 8 in the morning or whatever it was. And I was reviewing the plan. I had these notes and maps and diagrams. I was reviewing everything with them. Again, I'd never done this before. I did research myself and didn't want to do it, but no one was willing to take them. And I said, I'll try it this time, clearly outlining the risks. And I was reviewing the plan with them. And the one guy, the youngest of the group, he's this, he was a bigger guy, taller, bigger guy, and he was just very distracted by his first Big Mac. And I said to him, I was reviewing the plan, I said, what did I just say? And he just grinned sheepishly, and he wasn't paying attention, and all the other kids slapped him on the head and were like, you better pay attention, this is important. And I think about moments like that, and they're clearly children, we're reviewing like a life and death plan and distracted by eating at McDonald's. And they're clearly children, but they're also warriors. These children endured the they endured a famine. Some of them had been through the political prison camps. The same boy who was distracted by his first Big Mac, he said that his family ate two meals a day on average, and they were a middle-class family, and two meals a day of this corn porridge that they eat over there, and it's just a very small portion. That's what they would eat. Now, officially, the North Korean government, when I had written the book, they had asked North Korean citizens to help out their country by cutting down to two meals per day. And these are not normal meals. And he said on his birthday, he'll get a bowl of white rice. So that's his birthday present. He'll only be able to eat white rice once a year. And I think of these children, what warriors that they've overcome this. And to go after that, chase after that dream of chasing after, going after freedom, wanting freedom, willing to risk their lives to go after it all. And I think of them, what heroes and warriors these children are. They eventually got into the embassy, and I quickly made my escape. You see, Reuters did a news wire right after they got in, and they said that they got into the Chinese embassy safely. We learned that it was surrounded by police immediately after I left, and I made my escape. We tried to, it's kind of funny, after I got back to Beijing, China, we left them with a cell phone, and we left them with a cell phone so we could call them once they got into the consulate, so I called them to make sure they were okay, and once I got back to Beijing, I called them again, immediately called them, and they were okay. Once I got back to Beijing, someone had called me on their phone and had confiscated, it was one of the British workers, and said, is this the one who dropped them off? And so I was talking with one of the British consulate workers, and he wanted to find out more about me, where you're from, why did you bring them here, to the British consulate? And said, why don't you come in so we could have a chat? And I said, no thanks, and changed my phone number after that, threw away the SIM card. So they got in safely into the British consulate. They said that before they left, the Chinese PSB, the FBI, their FBI, the PSB said that they have to meet with them once before they leave to South Korea. They granted them permission to leave through the British consulate. And they met with them and said, the one thing you have to tell before you leave is who is this guy? And they had pictures and video footage of me from all the security cameras in the building. And we knew this would happen. I had a hat on and sunglasses. And I had prepped them. I said, you know, just tell them, give them my alias and tell them he's, you know, Korean-American from the States, here to help North Koreans. And they let them go. I learned this all later when I met with the children after they had come out of Hanawon, this orientation center. I met with the children. They told me about all of this. And so I, you know, shortly after that, I got a call from a government contact in China, a Chinese government contact. And he said, Mike, I've been hearing some stuff. Get out of here as quickly as possible. They're devoted a lot of resources to look for you. So get out of the country as quickly as possible. I made my escape for a few months and then came back again. Really saying I'm never going to do that again. It was way too stressful. I didn't want to do it in the first place. But you know, I met these people who needed help, and I wanted to do whatever I could to help them. When I shortly after returning to China, after a few month break, when security died down, I met Mrs. Lee and Miss Kim, and found out their story. Someone asked me to help them get to South Korea. I said, I'm not making any guarantees. Actually, I said I'm not going to do this anymore, but I'd be willing to meet with them and hear their story. Mrs. Lee was sick with tuberculosis, TB, a common disease in North Korea. A big problem, and we learned this later, but she was near death. She would have died within 2 or 3 weeks without proper medical help. Miss Kim was a victim of sex trafficking, sold to the highest bidding Chinese men. Met with them, heard their stories, was deeply moved, and I said, you know, again, I'm not making any guarantees, but I'll explore this Underground Railroad and see if there's anybody that wants to help you. So I made this journey. I flew to South Korea and met with some of the Underground Railroad activists. And said, can you please take these two ladies and help them? Everyone was saying, security is too tight right now. We don't want to do anything like this. Some people said they would help me again. I wasn't really comfortable with their plan. I said, you know what, I'll just explore it myself again. Someone gave me a tip. I call him Jim. He is a former diplomat living in China. Had some experience with the Underground Railroad. And he said, Mike, why don't you go to southern China border of Laos, go to this city, he wrote down the city and said, just go to the border and meet with some farmer families, and say, pay for a meal, give them about 100 RMB, which is about $12 at the time, and say, just tell them, you know, you want a meal, ask them to cook a meal for you, get a feel for them, and if you feel like you can trust them, then just ask them, can you help me illegally get into Laos? And I was naive and stupid enough, I guess, to do it. I said, okay, and I jumped on a plane, made my way to the border, and started doing that, meeting with families. I eventually found a family that said they would help me get into Laos. So I basically explored the border for about a week, kind of experimenting, going back and forth, talking to different families, meeting with some of the tribal people living in the mountains, and felt like I had a plan. I met with the women. I felt more comfortable because these were older women now. They could assess the risk and make the decision. Felt a little bit more comfortable. Told them the plan, and of course they said, you know, without a doubt, we want to do this. Please help us. I told Mrs. Lee, who was sick with TB, I said, train your lungs because it's a vigorous hike through the mountains in between China and Laos. Make sure you start taking long walks every day. She said, no problem. Whatever it takes, I'll make it through. You don't have to worry about me. So we made this journey through China and into Laos. And we were in the border of the two countries. And I distinctly remember being in limbo and walking. And you see these tribal guys. There's the Yao tribe is a popular tribe inhabiting that region. And I remember one tribal guy coming along and offering us something to smoke. And it's at that moment I recalled signs back in Laos when I was exploring the border, and it said, the sign said, don't buy opium, don't support the drug trade, the local drug trade. And it was at that moment that I realized, oh my goodness, we're using drug trafficking routes here to get in between countries, you know, in the Golden Triangle between Thailand, Laos, and Cambodia, Vietnam. And these are drug trafficking routes we're walking on. And the first thing I thought was, this is pretty cool. I was pretty fascinated by the fact that, you know, we were traveling between these border regions. And the second thought I had was, was very pleased by the thought that we were redeeming these drug trafficking routes to help sex trafficking victims get to freedom and safety. So we were in limbo between the two countries, and Mrs. Lee collapsed. So we had to take several stops. She collapsed on the ground. And I document the story in detail in the book. And she collapses and says, "Teacher Kim, I can't go on anymore. I've tried, and I can't. And I'll just die here, right here in these mountains. Just leave me, and you guys continue on." And I remember not really knowing what to say at the moment, but put my hand on her shoulder. And with all the intensity that I could muster up, I said, "You're not going to die here. We'll carry you if we have to. Take a break, drink some water, and we'll make our way into Bangkok, Thailand, and get you into the South Korean embassy." And so I don't know how, it's a miracle, but we took a lot of breaks, and eventually we made it into Bangkok, Thailand. You cross into Laos, it's a few hour drive over to the river to the west, then you take the Mekong River down into northern Thailand, and there either you take a car or bus into Bangkok, Thailand, and we made it. And we made it there, and afterwards, of course, all the women were in tears once they got to the South Korean embassy, and to this day, they often tell me, I leave my life. And especially, we got Mrs. Lee into a hospital in Bangkok, and because we couldn't get her proper medical help in China, of course, and she said, the doctor said, two or three weeks later she would have died. And especially her, she'll always tell me, I owe you my life. And there's this question of, how to save a life. There's the popular song out there, and it's the question we deal with all the time at the border. How do we save a life over there? But another question that's spun off of that for me personally is how to deal with saving a life. And to deal with that kind of gratitude, because she'll tell me, I owe you my life. And when I called her and her husband in South Korea, they're in Seoul now, and I call them, and I have to wait about a minute or two every time I call them, because she'll just break down crying when she hears my voice. She'll scream, "Teacher Kim," and then she'll break down crying, and for about a minute or two, and then, and I don't know how I feel about a woman crying every time I call her, but it'll take, a little bit of time, and then she'll say thank you, for saving my life. And I don't know, some people might like that kind of gratitude. I don't really like it. I don't want it. It's very uncomfortable to have someone tell you that. I don't know what to say. And I'd rather not have that. But that's been another question. How do you save lives, but how do you also deal with the gratitude of saving lives of these North Korean lives? So after they got the safety in South Korea, decided no more of these rescues. I didn't want to do either of them, really, and it was not in my game plan initially. And we made a policy change, our organization. We said, if we want to stay here long term, everyone I knew that was doing this work of crossing borders illegally was captured within a year and deported and blacklisted. So I knew I wanted to stay in China for longer than that. I wanted our organization to have a longer vision, longer term vision. So we said, we'll change our policy to helping North Koreans stay in China or return to North Korea. We'll help you with those two. We'll leave the work of getting to South Korea to other organizations. The important work of doing that, we said we'll let other organizations to handle that. So the next thing we went on to is helping sex trafficking victims. A major problem at the in Northeast China, at the border, because of, so we set up shelters and we'll help these women who were sex trafficking victims. And because of China's one-child policy, families, as many of you know, families are aborting children until, because they can only have one child, they're aborting children until they have a boy. And because of that, there's a short shortage of women in the country. I read one UN statistic that said by 2025, the year 2025, there'll be a shortage of women in China to the degree that 25 million was the number, 25 million men in China will not be able to find a spouse. So a major problem, this one-child policy. And because of that, currently in the South, the Chinese men are drawing from Southeast Asia and bringing in brides from there. In the Northeast, they're drawing from North Korea, bringing in brides there. And usually it's people that are financially not as well off, disabled, and farmers, or disabled, and they're usually farmers. So that was our work to help these women. Yuli is one of the women that we helped. She was, you see a picture here of her diagnosed with cancer. She was looking at the document and she had cancer. She's one of the victims. And on top, you see her describing the market scenario where she was sold. She says, he signaled 8 with his hands as my price for 8,000 RMB. He bargained down from 10,000 RMB. The man seemed happy with the price. And it really is like a market. In Northeast China, you know, it'll be a hidden venue, and they'll meet. The women will be, you know, have makeup. They'll be prettied up, and they'll shave several years off. You know, if they're 28, they'll tell them they're 23 because you'll make us more money. Girls that are too short or younger, you know, teenagers, they'll feed them and wait till they grow a little bit more before they sell them. And this is a fashion in which they're sold. And it's a huge problem. Statistics. You know, we did an informal survey of our shelters, and we wanted to know what percentage of our women were sex trafficked. And when we interviewed all of our women in our shelters, 97% of our women came as a result of being sold. It's a little bit higher than the norm of 70 to 80%, the average, but for us, for some reason, it was extremely high percentage. And there are two ways that trafficking happens. One is when the women travel into China in search for food, freedom, they'll be abducted by these human trafficking rings and sold. Or there'll be a Chinese businessman that goes into North Korea and makes a pitch and says to a family, we have a job for your daughter in a nearby, you know, in China, in a nearby factory. She's going to make a lot of good money, and as a result, she can send money back to your family. Of course, they enthusiastically agree. And once they cross the border together, they're sold. Yuli was sold this way. She had a man, a North Korean man, and a lot of this is done in partnership with Chinese and North Koreans, this business, this human trafficking business. And Yuli went to a man, a North Korean neighbor, and he told her, we have a job for you in a nearby city, and walked across the border into China, and she was sold. It's a business, you know. It's a profitable business for these guys, and they prey along the border and wait for women to come so that they can capture them and sell them. One time, what I did was we did a video documentary of this journey that women make to cross into China. When we were crossing in, there was one place, and we had this local guide taking us through this route. And you saw these dogs barking in this enclosed area, and they ran up to the fence and started barking. And I asked the guide, what are these dogs here for? And he said, they're here to detect North Koreans coming across, especially women, so that they can't make it by without these dogs detecting them. So it's a real functioning business going on at the border. Sadly, abuse and rape go hand in hand with trafficking. These women are raped by their traffickers, and then raped by the men that they're sold to. And you see the quote from Yuli at the bottom. She says, he had a mental impairment. When I refused to sleep with him, he hit me. His mother and sister also hit me. I would rather die than sleep with him, and fought with him with the family for 7 months. I received severe beatings. I had a bloody nose, ears, and swollen head. I cried every night. And one of the things I often talk about is the need for counseling at the border. And these women, they just brush their experiences under the rug. They never talk about it again. And just imagine the trauma experience and the issues of not talking about it. And it's great that, you know, these two did the work of counseling them and meeting with them in South Korea. And it's a huge need for these trafficked women. Medical needs is another big need at the border. Another reason that North Koreans will venture into China is for medical reasons, that they're deathly sick and they're going to die if they don't get in to China and get some proper medical help. So, but the problem is these cases are so bad that, you know, a few of these cases will wipe out any NGO's budget. And Yuli had cancer, we knew it, but we didn't have the funding to treat a cancer patient. So sadly, she passed away February 2007. That's a common problem at the border of, you know, where an organization is going to get the funding to treat these major illnesses. You know, I have a hard enough time in Western countries coming up with the money to treat these, and here at the border, it's been a big issue. One final thing I'd like to talk about on sex trafficking is rescues, another type of rescue, and that is the extracting trafficked women from their environments, you know, helping them escape from their quote-unquote husbands. And Pastor Kim was one of our staff members overseeing some of these shelters that were former victims of sex trafficking or currently victims. And a pastor, because a lot of, like the Underground Railroad during the Civil War, the one during the Civil War was largely, a majority of it was made up of Christian network of churches and pastors, and not fully, but there was a majority of it. And similarly, at the China-North Korea border, there's a lot of Christians and churches and pastors involved in this work. Pastor Kim was one of our staff members, and he was overseeing some trafficked women. And Ms. Kim, on the previous slide, the one I talked about that escaped to South Korea, not the one with TV, but the other one, her husband, we learned later, was a gangster in China. He was part of a gang. We only learned this later on. And he came looking for Pastor Kim. He knew Pastor Kim's face because he was giving assistance, and he said, he was giving her financial assistance, and he said, "Where's my wife?" And Pastor Kim, you know, wouldn't tell him, give up that information. So he and his friends abducted Pastor Kim, took him to the third floor of an apartment, and tied him up to a chair. They beat him up pretty good, and he wouldn't cooperate. He said, "Where is my wife?" He wouldn't tell them. And then they said, "Okay, well, if you're not going to tell us where she is, tell us where this teacher Kim guy is." They were looking for me. They had heard about me. We had never met, and he didn't give up that information as well. So they stepped outside the room. He overheard them whispering, saying, "He's not cooperating. Let's just kill him, and we'll toss his body, throw away his body, in a container, and we'll be done with him since he's not cooperating." He overheard them. He jumped from the third floor of the apartment, sprained both of his ankles upon landing, and sprinted for the nearest taxi. And when he got in, and they were chasing him, they heard him jump, they were chasing him, and he called me from the taxi and said, "Teacher Kim, something terrible has happened. I've got to meet with you right away." He called his family, told them to evacuate the home. I met him at one of our shelters. I walked in to see him with two ice bags on his ankles, his face bloodied up, beaten up from the beatings. And I had a conversation with him. I said, "You know, he told me everything that had happened." And I said, "Why don't you take a break from the work? You've been through a lot. This is a pretty traumatic experience." And he said, no, "I want to continue helping the North Koreans. That's what I've committed my life to. I want to help my people." Pastor Kim was a Korean Chinese local staff in the country. He was ethnically Korean, but born and raised in China, a Chinese citizen, like third or fourth generation. And he said he wanted to continue in the work. This is something I know that goes on with other areas where you have trafficking issues in Southeast Asia, South Asia. And this is something going on at the China-North Korea border as well. Helping these women who have been sold escape from those situations, and that was part of the work we did also. And this is just the last slide I really want to talk about. And I'm just going to breeze through it because I want to make sure we have a dialogue, and I want to field any questions that you might have. But problem of informants is another big issue. This is Mrs. Ju. She's an informant that penetrated into our circle and posed as a refugee needing help. And eventually, as a result of her, one of our Korean Chinese staff that was traveling back and forth into North Korea as a humanitarian, giving humanitarian aid, was imprisoned in North Korea for 3 months in a gulag there. It's a big problem, this problem of informants. There's different numbers going around as far as what percentage of refugees coming over are actually spies sent by the North Korean government. She turned them in, and I've heard 20%, 40%, nobody really knows. But Mrs. Ju turned him in, turned Missionary Lee, another one of our Korean Chinese staff, turned him in saying he's a spy working for the U.S. government with me, which is not true, but she made a dramatic story. Maybe she got more money that way. And he was captive for 3 months. Again, I document this in detail in the book. After we debriefed him, after the whole experience, we got him out with a ransom. Well, first, the Chinese government, they beat him near death, almost died in the prison. He illegally crossed into North Korea, so he went through the river. He didn't go via the customs, you know, through the border. So since he went illegally, there was no documentation of him entering the country. As a result, you know, Chinese government didn't know he was there. So they could have killed him, and the Chinese government would have never known. So he was beaten up pretty bad, and they said, all right, here's the deal. We'll let you go under these conditions. If you steal 2 cars for us in China and bring them in to North Korea, you know, give them to us, donate them to us, we'll let you go. And he's a farmer. You know, he's kind of from that border area. He's a farmer by trade, and said, I don't know how to drive. And even if I did, I wouldn't help you with that. Then they said, okay, we have another idea. Why don't you help us with drug trafficking? And you know, North Korea's involved in a lot of illicit activity. There's a drug trade, you know, counterfeit money, drugs as well, coming out of North Korea, being used to support the regime. And he said, they said, help us with our drug trafficking, getting drugs into China. And he said, I'd never do that either. And he said, just kill me if that's your deal. And eventually they agreed on a ransom. They set an amount that he'd have to receive, and we paid that ransom, and he escaped. He wrote a letter to me afterwards. He wrote a letter and a report to me afterwards. We debriefed him, and that's when we learned about all the details. I think of the staff as well. Joseonjok means Korean Chinese in Korean. And I think of the Korean-Chinese staff, majority of whom are engaged in this work, and I think, you know, what heroes they are dedicating themselves to this type of work also. I guess the final thing I really want to talk about is the book, I guess. For those that are interested, who had asked me, Gio had asked me to give some thoughts on how to get involved. LINK is one of the best organizations involved in this work. It stands for Liberation in North Korea. I work with them closely, good friends of mine. They're based in the U.S. I think they're the largest organization currently doing this work. If you're looking for ways to get involved, there's an email address, and you can check out their website as well. For the book, we only have a limited number of copies today. You can order it you can get it at Borders or on Amazon. That's my website, escapingnorthkorea.com. For those on Facebook, I just created a Facebook page recently. If you look up Escaping North Korea, it'll come up on Facebook. I'm planning on using that a little bit more to be interactive and have some discussions, ongoing discussions on the issue. And afterwards as well, I'll be around for anyone that wants to talk one-on-one. I'd be happy to do that. We had some great conversations yesterday at Cambridge. And afterwards, too, we're going to head out to a pub, I'm spending the night here, so anybody that wants to head out for a drink and chat over a beer, that works for me as well. And in closing, I'll just read a final paragraph towards the end of my book. A question I often get is, you know, how do you feel about your time over there? And it was the most rewarding 4 years of my life, but there's more. It was the most challenging, stressful, exhausting, lonely. I mean, you know, whatever, you name it, it was the toughest 4 years of my life, but very rewarding as well. And I'll always cherish this experience that I've had of helping the North Koreans. And really it was, as I said at the outset, I wanted to have, you know, I'll continue to be a nonprofit work in global issues the rest of my life, other ones in addition to the North Korean one. And of course, I'll continue with the North Korean one, but I'll value these unusual 4 years of my life. It probably sounds like I'm a bit crazy. You know, sometimes people, they just think I'm a nut. I'm not. I had a normal life once, and now I do again. I'm currently an MBA student at Georgetown. graduating in May. One of the next studies I'm doing is business in North Korea, studying the business environment and interviewing multinational corporations as well as small businesses. But here's a paragraph that sums up my experience at the border. Recently, I visited my friend Ed, who works for the U.S. Peace Corps in Fiji, for a few days of scuba diving. While we were diving, he updated me on his work and shared a quote by Lila Watson, an Australian Aboriginal woman. Apparently, it's a quote that every Peace Corps worker is exposed to early on in his or her two-year service. It reads, "If you have come to help me, you are wasting your time. But if you have come because your liberation is bound up with mine, then let us work together." There's a lot of truth in that short statement. When I first set out for China, I was not only following a calling, but also doing something that I had to do because I knew it would change me forever. Even before I jumped on that plane to China, I knew that I would be deeply impacted by the people I met there, more than they would be by my work. In moving to the China-North Korea border to help some of the most destitute people in the world today, I feel that I have been liberated. As much as I have taught them, they have taught me more. In helping them, I have gained a greater sense of purpose and fulfillment. They have forever changed my life. Thank you, and at this time, I'll take any questions that you might have.